I'm joined in studio now by Martin Dunn from Levittstown. He is the husband of well-known psychic, writer and broadcaster Una Power, who passed away earlier this month following dementia. And Martin, first of all, thanks for coming into studio. Condolences on the passing of Una. She was very popular, I know, right around the county, right around the country, and will be well-known to listeners here on KFM because she was a regular contributor as well. We're going to talk a little bit about the diagnosis of dementia and how you cared for her and maybe how you managed to cope with that diagnosis in a moment. But first of all, just put it into context for the type of person that Una was.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Owen. And I am really happy and blessed to have this opportunity to pay tribute really to what I think, and I think a lot of people would agree, was a remarkable woman. Remarkable in many ways because from a very early age, Una grew up in Bristol, an Irish family. Her father was Morris Power from Tramore. Her mum, Mamie Keating, from Levittstown, not too far from Atai. And for some unknown reason, they went to Bristol in the 40s. And at that time, Bristol was a bombed-out city, really, you know. But whatever reason they went there, they went there. And that's where she grew up. And from an early age, she was the oldest, and she had three younger brothers, Robert, Mike, and Roger. And from an early age, she was a very resourceful young woman and saw needs rather than wants in people from a very early age. What was needed and how to meet that need. And I remember one story she told me that I think she was about seven, is that she took her younger brother, Roger, by the hand down to the Mormon Centre in Bristol and knocked on the door and wanted to know, would they be interested in buying both of their souls, but could she have the money up front?
Could she have the money up front? And she was only 7 years of age.
She was only 7 years of age. A remarkable woman. And streetwise as well. And there was another occasion in which her writing became part of her life from an early age. She used to write plays and put them on at home and get her brothers to play all the parts in the play, all the actors. And she would charge the local children a penny in to see the play. And not only that, she charged them an extra penny then at the interval for some lemonade and biscuits.
So very entrepreneurial from a young age as well. And I know she brought that through later life as well. So
very much
great
so.
Stories, yeah.
And then she went off to she got a scholarship then to university in Bristol. And at that time, you know, scholarship kind of students were looked down on a little bit, you know, and being Irish as well was tough for her. But Una had been an incredibly resourceful person. And I think if there's one thing that I would say about Una is that she had always a way of connecting with people.
Yeah,
she was. Nowadays, people pay a fortune for to learn how to be a people's person or learn skills and how to communicate with other people. She had it in buckets, and she had it naturally. Wherever she went, she connected with people. And at the age of about 18, she had her son Robert, who we might talk about a little bit later, and returned to Ireland, and she did some work teaching then at the Carlow Regional College. But the thing about Una was that wherever you went with Una, you may forget your timetable. So if you had appointments for the day, you may forget about them, because if she met somebody who wanted to talk to her, that was it. Mm-hmm. All time was forgotten. The traffic would fade, the noise would fade, and Una would just totally, completely and utterly give that person her full 100% attention and time. Mm-hmm. And would not leave that person until there was some resolution or some solution for a focus kind of thing for them. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of person that she was. She loved to write. She wrote 10 books, and some children's books and some adult books. She had an agent in London who loved her. And as you know, from this very station, she loved to broadcast, and she was a natural communicator and broadcaster. and loved working here on KFM. And she also wrote an article for Woman's Way magazine that people really, really liked. She was the kind of person who believed not so much in social justice. It was a big kind of issue for her, even though she studied sociology at university. She was more about what was fair in life. What was fair? Could people be treated fairly, you know? Mm. And she would demonstrate this on a constant, constant basis. And I remember one time there was a young couple that she knew, a young family, and they had a little child, and they just found a flat in Dublin, and they had no furniture, they had no means, but they had a roof over their head. Well, everybody was commandeered into helping. And by the end of that day, and I remember myself walking up the main street in Stony Batter in Dublin with suites of furniture, the second-hand shops were raided. And by sundown, that flat was fully decorated and there was a cot there for the child and there was Delph and there was all kinds of things for the couple. That's the kind of person that she was. It was meeting the need of the person at all times. And She was also a psychic. Whether people believe in somebody being psychic or not is your own personal kind of thing. But the one thing about her psychic ability was that she would always leave somebody with hope.
Yeah.
She never left somebody from a session without a glimmer of hope for the future.
And that's what she would have been well known for here on KFM as well, and the countless interviews that she did. And you touched on her son Robert there, and it's an interview that sticks out with me from just listening back to it, and I know it stuck out with a lot of listeners at the time. So Robert, in 1992, he died by suicide at the age of 24, and she did an interview with Clem, and it was all about hope, and that word of hope, even though she had been through such a tough time, to give hope to other families who might have been affected by suicide.
Absolutely. There is a well-known psychologist who survived the concentration camps in the war in Germany, and he puts forward the idea of finding meaning in suffering.
Mm.
Trying to find meaning in suffering. When her son passed away and died by suicide, as you say, it was absolutely devastating for her. It absolutely nearly sank her completely. She entered into a sea of grief, a limitless, endless sea of grief, that it seemed at times that there was no coming back from. But slowly but surely, through a cascade and through an avalanche of words and then talk, she found a place where sorrow rests. That's what she found, a place where sorrow rests. And from there, she slowly but surely found enormous courage. And her faith was always very, very, very important to Una, and a belief in God, and a belief in that the people who have gone before us, we will meet them again. So slowly but surely, she began to find that place of a little bit of healing in herself, and she went public. And when she did, and I distinctly remember the interview that she gave with Clem, and it was groundbreaking, not only for its frankness but also for the help that it gave other families. The amount of correspondence she got, the amount of people who would stop her on the streets of Newbridge, of Nace, of Carlow, of Atai, and thank her profoundly for her courage, because it gave them courage. The stigma of suicide was finally the veil had been lifted on it, and now people could talk openly about it, that this inexplicable act, unexplainable act, that nobody had the foresight to see it coming, and it took a lot of the hurt away from families who felt that somehow they could have intervened if they had been there, if they could have said something, or could they have read something, or could they have seen something? Was there a pattern to this? And the fact about it, the fact about suicide is that there is no pattern. It's inexplicable. But for her courage, I am so proud of her to have known her not only as a husband and a friend, but also as somebody who had the courage to speak about it and to be frank about it. And the amount of healing that was done for many people was absolutely wonderful. And I must give great credit to Clem Ryan from this very parish, because he handled it with great dignity and great sensitivity, which allowed Una to relax and to formulate her ideas. And it was just a remarkable, remarkable interview that she did with him.
Already we're getting messages in of support and sharing memories of Una, which we'll get to at the end, Martin. But that's an idea of the type of woman that Una was, and anybody who knew her will echo exactly what you're saying there. Yeah. If we could fast forward to maybe 2016, 2018, where she started to fall ill. She had a stroke, I believe, in 2016 and was then diagnosed with dementia around 2018, 2019. What happened there and how tough was that?
Yeah. This is the part where my heart goes out to carers. Mm. This is a moment of comradeship, for want of a better word, with carers around the country. Some have help at home, and some do this stuff alone. Una was had a stroke in 2016, and it wasn't debilitating physically. It wasn't too bad. She spent some time in Nace Hospital and rallied back quite well. But then, about a year or two later, 2018, I began to notice that her memory, parts of her short-term memory, were beginning to be a challenge for her. Driving became a challenge for her. I'd get the odd phone call that she'd be lost in Carlow. She'd know Carlo like the back of her hand, and she'd say, "I'm lost here. I don't know how to get out of Carlo." The article that she used to write for Woman's Way used to take maybe 2 or 3 hours, was now taking 6 to 7 hours. And sometimes she'd get so frustrated that she would scrap it and start again the following morning. Odd little things, finding the shoes in the fridge, forgetting words. She was an avid reader. Her love of reading began to diminish a little bit. Her use of language began to diminish. And I think she was then diagnosed initially in late 2018 with vascular dementia, which was, they attributed that to the stroke. And it wasn't long after, about 6 months after, that she was diagnosed with Lewy body's dementia. And dementia as per se is like a spectrum. So you've got Alzheimer's and you've got vascular dementia, and then you have Lewy body's dementia. And Lewy body's dementia, most people would agree, is the most challenging, because it has three components to it. The first one is the dementia itself, which is the cognitive difficulties that people have with memory. The middle part is a Parkinson-like symptoms. There is shaking, hand-to-mouth coordination goes. There is this shuffle, as if a person, when they begin to walk, it feels like they're walking on pins each time. And the possibility of a fall then becomes greater for them. And then the third part, which I think is the most cruel part of this part of dementia, is the psychosis end of it. And the definition kind of that people have around psychosis is that when we go to sleep at night, we dream, and then we wake up again and we're back in a reality. But with psychosis and with this part of the dementia, is that the dream becomes the waking reality. Is that the person is still dreaming while they're awake. So they're beginning to see things that are not there, imagining people that are not there. And it's incredibly, incredibly distressing. So for the first, when she was diagnosed with Lewy bodies, for the first at least 6 to 7 months, she got no sleep and I got no sleep. I was a primary carer. and we were both exhausted, and I would be woken at all hours of the morning. It could be any time. There was no clock on this stuff, with screams and howls that would wake hell, you know. It was absolutely terrifying for her.
That word that you mentioned, distressing, Martin, I'm sure can be used twofold. So distressing for her and distressing for you to see what she is going through. And I know from experience as well, my own granddad who had dementia, and we talked about this on the phone the other day, and there'll be other people listening, and what you're saying will absolutely hit home with them.
Yeah,
it's so hard because the person themselves don't know what they're going through.
No, and it's absolutely terrifying for them. If we kind of think about it, and I was trying to formulate some ideas around this to simplify it in some way. If we think of it, traffic lights, so the green would be mild dementia, in which you can carry on the activities with the person, keeping up their social networks. If they play bingo, play bingo. If they go to the cinema, if they go to the GAA matches and so on, keeping that up. So that's the green zone. The amber zone, or the orange light on the to use the analogy of the traffic lights, would be the moderate. So we got mild and moderate. The moderate becomes a bit more difficult then, so that the person is a bit more stressed about going out. They're a bit more stressed about washing. They're a bit more stressed about eating. And then we're into the green zone then, which is the severe stage. And it didn't take very long with the Lewy bodies dementia for Una to reach the severe level. And that became incredibly, incredibly difficult. It was exhausting. And some of the things that I used to do, which would be familiar to many carers out there, I was told in the memory clinic originally to put signs up around the place. So that's the fridge, that's the kettle, that's the coffee, that's the fridge, that's the bathroom, and so on. Now, in the early days, that they were really helpful.
Yeah.
But as it went on, those very things that were meant to be aids became sources of anxiety and distress for her. So the fridge was like, what does a fridge mean?
Yeah,
because because of the short term memory was going, there's no memory bank to reach into. That's a fridge. It's new language. So because of the short term memory is going for the person, so all of those signs then became sources of distress for her. And another thing about that I was finding incredibly stressful from a personal point of view is that I kept asking myself, am I taking away too much of this woman's independence? Am I taking away her autonomy? Am I taking away her control? What I was trying to compensate for was to keep her safe in the house. So I began to take the sign away from the cooker, and the cooker became my domain. So I was doing the cooking. The remote control or things electrical and things like that, I began to take them away from her. And this, I felt incredibly guilty about this. But it wasn't me who was taking away her control. It was the dementia. And that's the message I'd like for carers to hear today. It is not you taking away the person's independence. It is the dementia that's taking away the person's independence. And it became incredibly unsafe around the house for her. And particularly with the Parkinson's then began to become really pronounced, is that she couldn't, a fork coming to her mouth became really, really difficult for her.
Mm.
And in the end, I would have to help her to feed.
Can I ask a question, Martin? And sorry to cut across you, but some people who have to deal with dementia and people who have been diagnosed maybe in the family, they're looking at maybe some of the things that you're after describing and thinking, this actually can't be happening. Like, not is she, or are they kind of not putting it on, but as in, it's so hard to see how they can go from being so healthy in to so unhealthy in a short space of time, if that makes sense, that the mind can go that quickly. And did you find that hard to comprehend?
It is an incredible question, Owen, because with Alzheimer's, for example, is that there's a long gestation or a long period of time for a person with Alzheimer's. So it's the 15, 20 years, 20, 30 years for some people. And that the graduation to that point of level of care comes in degrees.
Yeah.
With Lewy bodies, it's like great big falling steps, that when a person takes a step, they're going three steps down. And there's huge changes in the person, and trying to care for them is enormously difficult, because the changes are so profound and you're feeling so helpless in the changes that are happening for the person. There was a great psychologist from the 1950s called Milton Erickson. And Milton Erickson put forward the idea to truly understand each other and to have empathy for each other as human beings, we must enter each other's model of reality. And that's how we connect as human beings. And with Lewy bodies, what I found de-stressed me was agreeing with everything. Entering her model of reality as best I could, because what she was seeing, what she was feeling and what she was hearing was her model of reality. And I found it incredibly beneficial to enter into that. So if she said to me, "Oh, Mrs. Murphy called around this morning at 10 o'clock, I'd say, "Fantastic. What was she wearing?" "Oh, she was wearing that old coat that we'll see her out like." You know?
Yeah.
And I'd say, "Had she any news?" "Oh, she, that woman is never, she's full of bad news," like, you know. So I found that helpful to enter the model of reality.
As opposed to saying, "What do you mean Mrs. Murphy wasn't here? There's no way she was here."
I if there's one message I can give to any carer at all, is never, ever, ever disagree. Agree with everything. Agree with everything. If Arnold Schwarzenegger is sitting in the front room having a cup of tea, he's in the front room having a cup of tea. Because your feedback to that person, to their model of reality, de-stresses them. It makes them feel okay. It makes them feel... Where it becomes stressful for them is when it's difficult enough because there are lucid moments.
Yeah.
You know, Una had tons of lucid moments in which she'd say, "I have this fantastic idea for a story that I want to write." And I'd say, "Brilliant." And I'd get the pen and the paper and she'd sit down to write. And it was heartbreaking because her handwriting had become that of a six-year-old child.
And in a strange way, Martin, and again, it's just everything you're saying is reminiscing with my granddad, and people are texting in as well to say that they share in what you're saying. And in that, when you now can take a step back and look at your time caring for Una, there will be some moments, and I know in our family we can look back when granddad had dementia and think there were some very funny moments as well in there where he kept his wit. And, you know, there was a couple of times that he got my uncles to get in under the bed to pretend that they were changing the car, saying that this was the car, and you know, they had to change it. Or there was also one morning that he woke up in the middle of the night and there were seven horses standing out in the front garden. Now, there weren't, but we all went to the front window to look at them.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was delighted that we were all after looking at them. And I just want to read a couple of these messages that have come in. One here says, "I had the pleasure as a carer working alongside Martin and Una. I will never know where he got his strength from. God love him. May Una rest in peace." Another one here says, "I'm so sorry to hear that Una has passed away. I had a reading with her over 30 years ago and she was amazing. Everything she mentioned was spot on. She predicted my future to the letter. A lovely, lovely woman." Trish Proctor has been in touch as well. Trish is a good friend here of the programme and know she lives in Castledermot. She says, will you please give my regards to Martin when he comes on? He's a wonderful man. He looked after my friend Una. He was always so gentle with her. I'm proud to say it was Una who got me to put pen to paper with my writing. She was such a lady. Another message saying, you know, may Una rest in peace. And they're so sad to hear that. Just to finish up, and I think the purpose of this as well, Martin, is to remember Una, but also to give that message of strength and hope to those who are currently in the midst of a loved one with dementia, because it can be so, so hard.
Yeah.
It's been 3-4 weeks since Una passed away.
Yeah.
3 weeks. How have you found her? How are you coping?
If I'm going to be totally honest, my heart is broken, and I'm incredibly raw, and I call her my comrade and my best friend and my lover as well. Comrade because we both have, in our own ways, been soldiers on the battlefield of suffering in life in different ways. There's just one more thing with for carers is that it's never too early to make a scrapbook. Making a scrapbook of memories, and if you have photographs, to write the dates, and if you can remember the locations of them. I think we can do better. I think the services, I think the system can do better by people with Lewy bodies. I think it's very much understood within nursing homes and institutions. I think psychiatry can do better. At best, it's sometimes ad hoc. And sometimes, and I have witnessed this myself, and if you go to the Curragh ward any day, 90% of the people in the Curragh ward are there because they're there because most of them have Lewy bodies and they've been sent there by nursing homes who find their behaviour, they don't know how to manage their behaviour and they find that difficult. And some of them linger in the hospital for far too long, as Una did for nearly 3 months. And the nursing home made it incredibly difficult for her to return there, and it caused her untold stress. And you know, I think more is needed. We can do better as a society. We can do better by people with dementia, and we can do better by those who care for them. Psychiatry can do better. You know, carers can do better. There is fantastic training available in the UK at the moment of how to communicate with people with dementia. Hospitals can do better. There should be a designated area in all hospitals, including Nace Hospital, because the last place that you want to be bringing a person with dementia is into the A&E ward, whether they have a urinary tract infection or a break or something or other. It's overwhelming for them. The sounds, the noise is overwhelming, and there should really be a designated place for people with dementia in A&E departments. If I was to send a call out to HICWA, for example, I know HICWA don't deal with individual cases. I think HICWA should deal with individual cases with the nursing homes, because I think there is a lot to be learned, still to be learned, about how people deal with Lewy bodies dementia within nursing homes. And as soon as their behaviour becomes difficult, they ship them off to hospitals like Nace, and they leave them to linger and languish there for months on end. And that's not right. And that is cruel. And there has to be a change in trying to understand. If a child, for example, has a tantrum, we don't berate the child. We try and understand what is causing the child to have the tantrum. The behaviour is the language of a distress. The behaviour is not a person giving out about something. It is a demonstration of somebody's discomfort, anxiety, distress, and in a lot of times with dementia, depression. Depression, because they're losing their personhood. And we as a society should really take more responsibility, because getting old and getting dementia in this country is not a sin. It's part of our life journey. And if I was to say something, and if the Minister for Health is listening and gets to hear this programme, we have to do better when it comes to Lewy bodies. And it's cruel to send people whose behaviour become difficult in nursing homes off to A&E and off to hospital wards, and they languish there, and the nursing homes make it impossible for them to get back in. And also, on top of that, what the nursing homes do and the institutions do, the person has no access to get back in. They're denied access back to their home, and they're being charged rent for it.
Yeah.
And that can't be right.
No.
That can't be right. On a positive message, Una has been an incredible support to me personally as a human being. She has taught me so much about how to connect with people, how to always, always, always stop and speak to a person, no matter who they are. And she had that enormous, amazing gift that she could be in a room with millionaires one day and somebody who only had €2 in their pocket the next day. Nobody was treated any different in Una's world. Fairness, humanity, and connection, and we all need each other. And if there was one tribute I'd like to pay to Una, she was a remarkable, remarkable human being and a brilliant mother.
Very well said. And listen, thank you so much for coming in to us this morning and talking about it. And I know Una's Month's Mind is taking place the 2nd of July, isn't that right?
The 2nd of July in Castledermot, in the main church in Castledermot. Now, I know a lot of people missed out on the original announcement. She passed away, bless her, on the 1st of June. And word didn't, the communications were just messed up, and word never got to KFM, because she would have wanted people on KFM to know. But the Month's Mind is on the 2nd, Sunday the 2nd of July at 11 o'clock to a beautiful Mass in Castledermot Church. And I'd love to see as many people there who've missed out on the funeral as possible. And may I say to you, Owen, thank you so much.
Thank you. That's Martin Dunn. And again, condolences and thanks for those fantastic words. And so many messages coming in. Another one here says, so sad to hear about Una. Love to her husband. Una was a beautiful lady. That comes in from Caroline. Another one here says, dementia, it's the long goodbye. My family are going through all of those stages that Martin mentioned, and so much more that we'll catch up on as well. Martin Dunn from Levittstown, husband to Una Power, who passed away following dementia earlier this month. Thanks again, Martin.